Hello everyone. Dandies. Non-being. Newton. The Cold War. Beckett. Barbie. Tina Brown. George Steiner. Charles I. The Golden Man Booker. Ice skating. Sleep. That's a list of just some of the topics covered in the current issue of the TLS. Compared to most magazines, it's a palace of varieties. A literary lucky dip. At times editing it, I thought this week must seem like the journalist equivalent of making store cupboard brownies, like the one Stig was tweeting about over the weekend, when apparently the ingredients his daughter used included, and here I'm quoting from his tweet, bashed up cookies, chocolate chips, and a galaxy ripple. But clearly it worked. In the picture Stig posted, they looked delicious. Crispy in some places, gooey in other places, full of little surprises all round. And the TLS, this is the Radio 4 link.
Yeah.
The TLS also works. It's a model of order and variety. It gives readers what they want, but also what they never knew they wanted till they saw it there in black and white. And that's probably one reason why its circulation went up 20% last year. Whether it's on the page or it's online, it makes readers and writers feel they're part of a conversation that matters. Now, in his first lecture on Friday, Stig pointed out we should probably enjoy that kind of thing while we can. And that's because Fleet Street simply isn't quick enough, despite its name, to keep up with the mayfly existence of news stories as they're born and then take flight and then die. Today, in the second final lecture, he's going to say more about what we can look forward to in the future, maybe what we can do about it. And as before, he's going to talk for about 40 to 50 minutes, and there'll be time for questions and for discussion after that. Anyway, much more importantly, please join me in welcoming the brilliant Stig Abel.
Hello, thank you so much. Robert wrote about ice skating in the TLS this week, which he almost was too modest to mention there. Thank you so much for coming on this particularly freezing day. This is the second lecture on the end of journalism, which may or may not needs a question mark. But I'm very grateful for you coming. If you missed the first one, I'll do a brief summary of the problems facing traditional media using the metaphor of a viral video. Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? I'll do it again. There we go. Traditional media, small dog looking up. What can we do? Sweeping change not foreseen has left legacy, mainly print media, perilously close to being overwhelmed. On Friday, we discussed the business model for written journalism, both in print and online, and how near it is to collapse. In America, more than 20,000 journalism jobs have been shed in the last 10 years. In Britain, the number of journalists working in local newspapers has halved in the same period. There are more PRs working in London than there are journalists. The best-selling newspaper in Britain, The Sun, and the best-selling broadsheet, The Telegraph, both sell less than half the amount they did in 2000. Why is this a problem? Well, all the new revenue in the realm of advertising is swallowed up by two vast American conglomerates, Google and Facebook, neither of whom have the incentive nor the inclination to support journalism. But I didn't talk much on Friday about broadcast journalism, so I'm going to remedy that now before returning to the industry more generally in the digital age. So here's a quick potted history of radio and television for you. The story of British broadcasting, of course, begins and ends with the BBC, which is one of the most visible, important, and with some caveats, largely wonderful aspects of our national identity. I probably would say that. It's also a ubiquitous presence funded by a compulsory tax that represents a commercial threat to the free media market, employing more than 20,000 people on guaranteed revenues of more than £3.5 billion a year. That's the reason it's given such a hard time in the press. John Reith, the Presbyterian autocrat who shaped the organisation from its inception, said this very early on. Some prophets are foretelling a colossal struggle between the powerful press interests and ourselves. I do not believe there need to be any such thing. If he could only read the Daily Mail or the Times or the Sun now, he would change his mind very quickly. The BBC's origins, of course, stem from the invention of radio and its development by Guglielmo Marconi, a fascist, as it happens, whose tomb in Italy bears a quote from Mussolini. Came around at the turn of the 20th century. And it was from his British company, Marconi's British company, that the first entertainment transmission was broadcast in 1920. It was a performance by Dame Nellie Melba, sponsored by the Daily Mail, at which the scale and potential of radio broadcasting became abundantly clear. The technology had to involve the state, though. Radio broadcasts made use of a limited spectrum of electromagnetic wave frequencies that was also used by civil and military communication. And I'm not going to explain that any further because I don't fully understand it. But the point was the government needed to control the spectrum's use. And so by 1922, the idea of licensing was developed to manage access. At the same time, it was decided that control over broadcast activity could not be delegated to commercial institutions, which might exploit it in a shameless and populist fashion. So there was this, but there was disquiet at the same time about it being entirely in the hands of the government. So being Britain, we developed a classic British fudge. The BBC in 1927 was formed as a corporation, guaranteed by Royal Charter, funded by a compulsory levy on wirelesses. And the BBC in its early years was worthy and intellectually impressive, both in terms of news, which started in 1928, and artistic efforts. Virginia Woolf presented three pieces on BBC Radio, beginning with the question, are too many books being published in 1927? A question to which the answer was probably yes then, and is certainly yes now, and ended with her thoughts on craftsmanship in 1937. The BBC didn't used to keep recordings of its output, but it just got the end of craftsmanship. Would you like to hear a bit of Virginia Woolf talking on the radio? Here it is.
Words, English words, full of echoes, memories, associations, can be out and about on people's lips, in our houses, in the streets, in the fields, for several centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they've contracted so many famous managers and parts.
It's an extraordinary accent, and there's actually a dispute among surviving people who knew Woolf whether she actually talked like that in real life. I kind of hope she didn't, but in the BBC at that point, everyone spoke in the same accent. How different it is today. The director of talks for radio at the time, by the way, was a blue stocking figure called Hilda Matheson, who did much to shape the credibility of the early BBC. She was also, rather wonderfully, conducting an affair with Virginia Woolf's lover, Vita Sackville-West. Her letters, often on BBC-headed paper, survive in the BBC archive, and they're rather charming. So this is written on BBC-headed paper all day ever since that blessed and ever to be remembered indisposition. It's an interesting word to use. I have been thinking of you, bursting with you, and wanting you, oh my God, wanting you. Matheson was also invented the radio programme Week in Westminster, which was designed to enable female MPs to speak directly to the new newly enfranchised female voters. That show still exists today. And from the very beginning, the pomp of the BBC was established and reinforced, its purpose characterised as to inform, educate and entertain, to place, in the words of its foremost presiding spirit, John Reith, the best of everything into the greatest number of homes. The best of everything into the greatest number of homes. The arrival of television, a medium perhaps less refined than radio, has placed often unbearable strain on these principles, it must be said. Hole in the Wall show, which I'm sure you've all seen, where people have to try and contort their shapes into a hole in the wall so they don't get wet. I don't know what John Reith would have made of that. But the Second World War delayed TV's arrival, and by 1947 only 20,000 households were in the range of its broadcast base. But the pace of development swiftly increased. So TV as we know it really postdates the Second World War. By 1954, commercial television was allowed as a rival to the BBC. which itself drove change, especially in news broadcasting. Here the challenge had always been to find a way to tell stories that might resist easy images, which is why, this is an interesting fact, golf was successfully televised on the BBC before a news programme ever was. And it took the commercial sector to make the breakthrough in how to do it well. So independent news television, ITN, arrived in 1955 to help formulate the answer. Satellites were launched in 1962 that could broadcast images from around the world. And by 1967, ITN's News at 10 created the modern news broadcast, which is more or less what we see today. In radio, thanks to the ubiquity of the wireless, Dennis Potter called it a walled, fluted and beknobbed oblong which could allow anyone to feel like Joan of Arc. The BBC kept a virtual monopoly for years. By the 1960s, there were pirate radio stations, such as Radio Caroline, transmitted from offshore ships and forts to avoid the requirement of the licence. These are significant broadcasters with healthy advertising, including ads from the government. Even though they were illegal, they had a combined audience of 15 million. And pirate stations still exist, incidentally, but they've moved from the sea to the city. There are about 150 urban pirate stations in the UK, listened to by an often ethnic audience keen to hear authentic voices from their own community. About a quarter of all Londoners listen to pirate radio, which may be a testament to the fact they can't find their voices easily represented in the mainstream. In 1967, the law was changed to make marine broadcasting illegal, and the BBC saw the opportunity to expand, creating radios 1, 2, 3, and 4, and individual local stations. At the same time, licences were granted to commercial radio stations, and the first one to arrive in 1973 was the London Broadcasting Company, or LBC, as it is now known. Its remit was to produce this, news presented without the slightest editorialising, but not without opinion or comment. It undertook that each comment will be prefaced by the statement that a personal viewpoint or prejudice is about to be expressed. I don't think they ever did that, and that disclaimer certainly goes unstated. Now, the LBC has grown over the last few years and now has 2 million listeners, and it fills a niche of broadcasting partisan opinion that the BBC, for whatever reason, feels incapable of doing. Now, I hosted an LBC show for 3 years, and it's an invigorating, very lo-fi experience in an area where journalism, if you can call it that, is doing rather well. 2 million listeners a week is quite a significant number. I've heard people at the BBC referring to it as the future of radio. I don't know how much it's sort of penetrated this sort of shady grove of academia. So I thought I might explain how an LBC show works to you. So the idea is you pick a subject for an hour and then develop a pointed angle on it. At the beginning of the hour, you have to churn for calls, it's called. And that's talking until people feel moved to phone in, and you sit there with a switchboard monitor in front of you. It's completely black at the beginning, and it's got 12 sections in it, each of which lights up when a caller comes in. So you're talking, and as you're speaking, you have to see a flashing beat of someone calling in. And the horror, as you might imagine, is when it remains resolutely black, and you're talking, thinking, I'm saying something quite provocative and interesting, and there is a wall of silence that meets you. You've got to keep talking and talking and talking until something clicks. It's very, very lo-fi, as I said. It's very opposite of how the BBC works. And then when someone calls in, you have a row with somebody, and that's really the point of the station. And I thought, this is me. Last year, I think, talking to an Orthodox Christian about homosexuality and gay marriage. And it's a bit blurry, but I thought I'd play a bit so you can get the flavour of the tone of LBC.
There's a set of rules. As I understand it, the Bible contains a set of rules. Those rules are either, to a greater or lesser extent, bonkers. Some of them are sensible, some of them are from their period, and they're utterly out of date. Why isn't the one about homosexuality just utterly out of date? We shrug it off and we move on.
Because you can't do that.
Why? We move on in every other respect. Do you take part in loaning at interest? Because the Bible says you're not allowed to do that.
No, that's got nothing.
I've got a beard. The Bible has rules about beards which I'm broken. You've got a beard. They're the same thing.
That's got nothing to do with it.
Why?
Homosexuality. It speaks.
That's the other thing we're talking about.
I don't know, but I.
Well, you don't know. Listen to me. I can give you a piece of advice. Either you live your life like it is, you know, 600 BC, and you live all of your life like that, or you say, do you know what, that's a really old book. The world has got better. We've evolved, we've got more civilized. And when I see two dudes walking along together, I think, God, isn't it nice that they love each other, they found someone, that's happiness, it doesn't hurt me, that's good. And if God does exist, which I think is unlikely, he would agree with that, sure.
Homosexuality is a thing.
We may never agree, but thank you.
So it's pretty high level, it's very like Radio 4, as you can imagine. I do apologise for that t-shirt and hair. But LBC has tapped into something of the zeitgeist, I think, clickable controversy. Short videos of hyper-partisan opinion geared to Facebook and Twitter. What it does very well is it packages little clips better than that and puts them on Facebook and has created a whole online audience for itself. It's not hugely profitable, but it is of our time. And it's a very pure sense of broadcasting, because it places you in touch with the shifting sentiments of the public. I knew, for example, that Jeremy Corbyn would do well in the 2017 election, because I kept having phone-ins and people from all over the country would call in and say, something's happening, Jeremy Corbyn is a significant figure, we're going to vote for him, and people of different ages and social backgrounds. Brexit was exactly the same. Every time we had a phone-in on Brexit, the vast numbers of people who would call from all over the country saying they were pro-Brexit made you start thinking something significant is happening. And so it's radio that's in touch with its audience. I also did an entire show on LBC with a stomach bug and spent every ad break throwing up in the bathroom. You can't do that in the BBC either. But let's go back to the BBC. It used its access to this wireless license fee, and this is the thing you remember about the BBC, to develop the technology for TV. So it took the money from wirelesses and it developed TV technology. And it did exactly the same thing 70 years later with online. It took the money it made from TV licensing and shoved it into online, which is why it's such a significant player. In 1946, the TV license came in. It was £2 a year, which is £75 in today's money, and increased to £10 in 1967. That's 157 quid. That's more than it is today. And few things are more controversial in the media than the BBC license fee. You pay your £145.50. If you own a TV, or you use the iPlayer, or if you use any technology to watch programmes designed to appear on television, which is a very woolly categorisation. In 2013, about 1.9 million households said they had no need of a licence. About 5% of all customers annually evade the fee despite using the services. Enforcement officers working for the BBC make 4 million visits a year to check up on people. And in 2014, there were 200,000 prosecutions. It's a hell of a lot. And the criticism of this system is very obvious. The tax is flat. The licensee is flat, and so it's regressive. It takes a greater percentage of a poor person's income than a rich person. It's enforced via the mechanisms of the state. A ninth of all magistrates' cases in this country are about TV licensing. An extraordinary figure. Weirdly, it also seems to fall more heavily on women than men. 70% of all convicted evaders are female, and licensing prosecutions constitute a third of all court cases against women. Other problems with the license fee. The guaranteed income of the BBC compromises the otherwise free market for news. Its financial heft means it can dominate the market in local areas, driving newspapers effectively out of business. And it's unquestionably anachronistic. The thing I was talking about, the spectrum scarcity, when you had to apply to government to get part of the spectrum, meant that it was a monopoly you were devolving from government. The internet means that anybody can make a television programme. Anybody can watch one. But here's the thing. The BBC, the argument will go, if the BBC is worth this money, it will make a subscription service that people will voluntarily pay for. That's what critics of the BBC will say. If it's good enough, people will voluntarily pay for it. And yet, and this is the critical point, as we're going to see further, the internet has destroyed the notion of free market for journalism. The financial basis for much journalism today is non-existence. The existence of the license fee acts as a guaranteed funding mechanism for the professional production of news and features. Facebook might take all of the advertising earnings from journalism. In fact, it certainly does, but it doesn't fund any of the actual content. The BBC funds high-quality news gathering and high-quality programme making, and can continue to do so thanks to the licence fee. So it used to be this great baddie if you worked in newspapers. But compared to Facebook, the BBC is actually performing a valuable public function. In 1954, the Television Act that allowed the advent of commercial television also formulated the requirements of broadcast impartiality, itself now under threat as an idea from the internet. And impartiality is one of these critical issues that crops up in broadcasting. As broadcast journalism was beamed directly into our homes on stations that required a license from government, it was felt that it couldn't be partisan or polemical in the same way that a newspaper could be. You have to actively purchase a newspaper or pick it up. The only problem, and this is really seldom acknowledged by people in broadcasting, is that it is philosophical nonsense. No person or institution can be impartial. Humans are hardwired to be partial, to have opinions, to take sides. And yet broadcast impartiality is a regulatory fact. It's enforced by the broadcast regulator Ofcom. This is how the BBC teaches its staff about impartiality. It's not the same as objectivity or balance or neutrality, although it contains elements of all three, nor is it the same as simply being fair, although it is unlikely you'll be impartial without being fair-minded. At its simplest, it means not taking sides. Impartiality is about providing a breadth of view. Imagine if you're a journalist and you're asked to follow through on those ideas. How is such a wishy-washy notion enforceable? And the answer is it's not in any credible way. Broadcasters in Britain are far more cautious and fair-minded than newspapers, absolutely. But they can never truly be impartial. And journalists on Channel 4 News, for example, scarcely trouble to pretend to be. They're punchy and spiky and have attitude. The BBC, I think, attempts to be balanced often to a fault. It's perhaps too willing to run a minority countervailing view in the aim of balance. Look what happens with Brexit or climate change, etc. And it's always had this problem, It's been characteristically self-conscious about doing so. This is the Director General of the BBC in 1965. There are some respects in which it is not neutral, unbiased or impartial. That is where there are clashes for and against moral values, truthfulness, justice, freedom, compassion, tolerance, for example. Nor do I believe that we should be impartial about certain things like racialism or extreme forms of political belief. It's well said, but very hard to enforce. Is climate change denial an extreme form of political belief? Is the rise of a far-right party extreme or an example of racialism? How balanced can one be in a world constantly tipping out of joint? The BBC retains a degree of trust, something we'll come back to, largely because of its admittedly well-funded professionalism and celebration of reason. But it still gets itself into a fearful bunch of messes sometimes. And I'm going to talk a bit about BBC scandal, because the shape of the BBC scandal is actually rather fixed, and it tends to happen every couple of years or so. There's an error of judgment, underreaction, overreaction, self-flagellation, and repeat. And that really goes on every 2 years at the BBC, and you can see it like clockwork. As a news organisation, the BBC has a far prouder record than almost every other journalistic institution in this country. But because it's funded compulsorily by the public, it's rightly held to a higher account. And that can be taken too far. When Andrew Gilligan in May 2003 broadcast on the Today programme the claim that the government had sexed up the dossier claiming that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons, the resultant scandal led to the suicide of his source, the scientist David Kelly, and a judicial inquiry under Lord Hutton. Hutton eventually produced a report blithely uncritical of government, but swinging in its remarks about the BBC. The chairman of the BBC, Gavin Davis, resigned, as did its Director General, Greg Dyke, as did Gilligan himself, saying this, not without justification. It seeks to hold reporters, with all the difficulties they face, to a standard that it does not appear to demand of, for instance, government dossiers. And the problem here is a classic BBC problem. It's too unwieldy to deal with what was a relatively straightforward claim of inaccuracy, which was only partially justified. It had no effective mechanism to correct the individual details while standing by the inarguable thrust of the story that political self-interest had interfered at some level with the intelligence progress ahead of the Iraq war, and it became enveloped in antagonism that it couldn't free itself from. Same sort of thing happened in 2008 when the TV presenter Jonathan Ross appeared on comedian Russell Brand's radio show and left the prank call on the phone of actor Andrew Sachs, in which Ross and Bran made jokes about his granddaughter, a young woman called Georgina Bailey. And if you remember the scandal, this would have sounded
Look,
like.
Look, Andrew Sachs, I've got respect for you and your lineage and progeny. Never let that be questioned.
That's a hint.
But why are you hinting? Why did you let come across the hint?
Because you know what you're
doing. Now, how do you
It's Andrew's your granddaughter.
That's his answer, phone.
I'm sorry.
I did not do nothing with Georgina.
Doesn't date very well, that. The whole enterprise, actually, from the start, was laughable and very laughably British. Two overpaid presenters behaving yobbishly, a man whose central television role was a crypto-racist portrayal of a hapless Spaniard in Fawlty Towers, a woman, Georgina Bailey, who not only had the misfortune to have had sex with a sesquipedalian comedian like Russell Brand, but also then was found to have been involved in burlesque in a show called Georgia Bailey's Satanic Sluts. So it became this ridiculous story. The Brand show aired on the 18th of October, and more or less nobody noticed. They heard that, and they just ignored it. On the 25th of October, the Mail on Sunday was having problems with its splash. Now, you can often tell when Sunday newspapers lose their main story on a Friday or Saturday. This happens quite a lot in Sunday newspapers. They build something up through the whole week, and then it falls apart. And what they have to then do is grope around for something that should have remained tucked inside instead. So a shortish media piece having a go at Russell Brand was set to appear in the middle of the Mail on Sunday. Because I think there'd been three complaints and someone wanted to have a chance to have a go at the BBC. So it was about page 20, I think, on Saturday morning. And things fell away. It was gradually edged forward throughout the day. And finally, lacking any other option, the editor gave it some welly on the front page. BBC obscene phone calls to actor Brand and Ross could face prosecution. So this turned what was a minor media story into a full-blown scandal. The BBC received a massive number of complaints, which it hadn't done when people had listened to the show, had nowhere to put them, had no immediate decision in response, underreacted, then overreacted. The control of the Radio 2 resigned, Brand resigned, Ross was suspended, and it moved on. But it couldn't deal with the problem in a proportionate fashion. In October 2012, so 4 years later, the flagship news programme Newsnight was debating whether to run a story about BBC legend and it was becoming evident notorious serial paedophile Jimmy Savile. It decided not to run it, and claims were raised that it compromised its journalistic integrity. The BBC underreacted, did nothing, then overreacted, it announced an independent inquiry by former Sky News journalist Nick Pollard. Meanwhile, its other flagship news programme, Panorama, investigated the BBC itself and was given a no-comment response by the then Director General, George Entwistle. So that was going on. And then the interim Newsnight got into trouble again. This time it had decided to cover, not conceal, a paedophile story involving a man allegedly senior in the Conservative Party. In advance of broadcast, it had tweeted, and if you remember this, the senior Conservative involved, which many of the social media then identified as Lord McAlpine. And this actually incidentally established a legal precedent that comments on Twitter could be caught by the standard publishing laws of libel and privacy. Sally Burkow, the wife of the Speaker in Parliament, had tweeted, "Why is Lord McAlpine trending, innocent face?" McAlpine sued her and 20 other significant figures on Twitter and either obtained a settlement or enforced compensation. But he died a broken man in January 2014 as a result of all of this. The problem for Newsnight was that it couldn't prove he was a paedophile, because he wasn't, and had not gone to him in advance to check the facts, and it was subsequently forced to concede he wasn't a paedophile. The internal mismanagement machine of the BBC then swung into action. It did very little, and then overreacted, and George Entwistle, the Director General, had to appear on the Today programme with John Humphreys. Do you want to hear a clip of him talking to John Humphreys?
Disciplining other people, but at no point will you say to yourself, I, George Entwistle, should have been much more alert to the dangers in all this. I should have been watching it like a hawk right from the very beginning. Everything Newsnight did in this area, I should have been on top of. not editing the programme down there on the stone, as it were, but I, the Director General, the Editor-in-Chief, should have been on top of everything that programme did. I was remiss in that. It's no good me blaming other people because I am the boss. Do you not see that people will say, he's talking about disciplining other people, he's not saying, I was remiss.
John, you're effectively asking me to become the editor of Newsnight. I wasn't.
I'm not. I'm absolutely not doing that. It has an editor. He answers to you. You, therefore, should have said to him, what are you up to on board?
I was editor of Newsnight. I know what level of attention and detail that takes.
You answer to your bosses.
That is where that level of scrutiny should take place.
And I'm not with you at all. You're entirely blameless.
And I answer to my bosses. I answer to the trust. I am
so
a director general.
The Trust says to you, Mr. Entwistle, we're worried about the way you've been running the BBC in this regard, this vitally important regard over the past few weeks. Not unless they do that will you consider your own position. Is that right?
John, I am a director general who has encountered these problems and is doing everything. I'm doing everything I can. I believe I'm doing the right things. I know that there are times when I was thought to be a bit slow over saddle. I could have been a bit quicker to move to announcing the independent inquiries by a few days. I've admitted that. But the truth is, I'm doing the right things to try and put this stuff straight. That I am accountable to the Trust in that endeavour. If they do not feel I'm doing the right things, then obviously I will be bound by their judgment.
He resigned about 2 days later. And it's hard to conceive of another news organisation in the world where the boss would be filleted so thoroughly by a journalist he had no option but to leave his job. And the BBC's self-flagellation is somewhere between noble and self-defeating. This is from the pay scandal a couple of weeks ago on the Victoria Derbyshire programme. This guy from BuzzFeed tweeting this. The BBC just asked the BBC for an interview, but the BBC said that nobody from the BBC is available yet. And you'll see this all the time. They send their media editor to stand outside their own building where someone inside is refusing to talk to him. Soon after the Newsnight affair, yet another report by the BBC had been commissioned, this time from Dame Janet Smith, into the culture of the organisation during the Savile period. It finally appeared in February 2016 and made clear that Savile had abused 72 people, including children, at virtually every one of the BBC premises at which he worked, and that a culture of not complaining and an atmosphere of not complaining had persisted at the corporation. On the face of it, this was a genuine scandal and somewhat underplayed. If phone hacking, and we talked about this on Friday, was sufficient, rightly so, for a judicial inquiry into the entire newspaper industry, why was institutionalised rape at a public body not examined in the same way? In the case of Savile and sexual abuse, the BBC for once had been guilty not of overreacting. But they're the shapes of the BBC scandals. And amid all that talk, we shouldn't forget the BBC is still more trusted than most institutions. But trust everywhere is falling, and not just in the world of print media. And this seems to be an inevitable consequence of the postmodern world in which we inhabit. Postmodernism is a movement not only in the arts but in our collective consciousness that examines the structures behind the structures. It looks questioningly at authorities and demands that the workings be shown. It's not a bad thing. Intrinsically, the blind obedience to those in power has historically allowed despotism, religious warfare, and untold misery. But here's the problem with our postmodern world. If you disbelieve all authorities, you lose sight of any means to judge between the real and the fake, the honest and the malign. And that disbelief is now the spirit of the age. In 2003, according to YouGov, 81% of people trusted the BBC, 65% trusted broadsheet papers, 36% mid-markets, and 14% trusted tabloids. You can see where it was in 2015. And that was before, really, the fake news phenomenon happened at all. It'd be much lower than that now. That's a collapse. Leaving aside the fact that tabloids have never been much trusted, this is a collapse in any faith in the media as a whole. Andrew Marr said, somewhere along the road, journalists stopped being shabby heroes confronting arrogant power and became sleazy, pig-snouted villains. And that's sadly true. But it is, and this is my point about an entire culture of mistrust that has arisen, no longer simply a media issue. In the last decade, trust in police has fallen by 23%, doctors by 11%, teachers by 18%. We're intoxicated by our newfound ability to question anything, and therefore everything. We are, without realising it, prisoners of our cynicism. If we're led to believe we cannot believe anything, then the emphatic blurts of Donald Trump have the same status as a peer-reviewed medical journal. The howling shriek of a conspiracy theorist gets the same respect as the political editor of the BBC. And furthermore, to protect ourselves from the increased rage and angst that our suspicions have caused, we retreat into circles that only echo our opinion. This is the so-called filter bubble effect. We read and share material that already accords with our beliefs in an attempt to fit in with the peers who share those beliefs. We become very clubbable. The cultural theorist Mark Fisher said this about online culture, that it comes from a priest's desire to excommunicate, an academic pedant's desire to be the first to be seen to spot a mistake, and a hipster's desire to be one of the in crowd. And none of those things are hugely laudable positions to be. There is some upside, of course. Inaccuracy in a world of accessible pedants can be challenged more easily. But the reverse is true. The overwhelming force of the in crowd also means that reality no longer matters. Bullshit can triumph. Indeed, if you go on social media, you'll regularly find this quote attributed to Winston Churchill, or sometimes Mark Twain. And neither of them said it. But people, you see it everywhere you go. And it's true. Neither of them said it, but the sentiment is correct nonetheless. And this is the world that we live in, where mistruths were probably a little heavier, a little more weighty, a little more slow on their feet, and now they buzz around quicker. Our world of fake news and post-truth content creation, it's not opposed to reality, it's utterly heedless of it. This is from the journalist Evan Davis on the definition of post-truth. And it's interesting that three books on the subject of post-truth were published last year at exactly the same time. One by Matthew D'Ancona, one by Evan Davis, and one by James Ball. Three books, the same title. And he makes the point that rather than simply referring to the time after a specified situation or event, as in post-war, post-match, the prefix in post-truth has a meaning more like belonging to a time in which the specified concept has become unimportant to irrelevant. This nuance seems to have originated in the mid-20th century in formations such as post-national, post-racial. So post-truth, truth isn't opposed, isn't challenged. It just doesn't matter. Harry Frankfurt wrote a famous essay in 2005 called On Bullshit, and he made the same point. It's just this lack of connection to a concern with truth, this indifference to how things really are, that I regard as of the essence of bullshit. And it's the heart of the phenomenon of fake news, stories produced solely for economic benefit, which have no interest in covering reality. Journalist Craig Silverman from BuzzFeed analysed the top 50 fake news stories on Facebook in 2016. Six came from a site called abcnews.com.co, with headlines like Obama signs executive order banning the Pledge of Allegiance in schools nationwide, or Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president, releases statement. None even tried to be genuine. And weirdly, much of the early pro-Trump fake news material originated in one town, in Macedonia, Veles, population 45,000. And this isn't the hotbed of Trumpian radical republicanism. It's simply a town with a bunch of young people who realised that they could confect stories with a political angle and earn up to £5,000 a month from advertising. They weren't concerned with the truth or otherwise. It was just something to push out there, some content to create. And if you were pro-Trump on Facebook, you'd share it. If you were anti-Obama, you'd share it. And the same thing was happening on the other side of the political debate as well. And this pure fake news phenomenon is mostly an American issue. British people, here's a moment of pride for you all, are less vulnerable to outright invented news. The problem is because we've already admitted hyper-partisan clickbait nonsense into our cultural mainstream. So you have the newspaper industry, which certainly do it, and then new contenders. Websites like the Canary and Squawk Box have also risen up, purely designed to field a market of left-wing conspiracy theories. That's what they do. The business model of the Canary is interesting. It's based upon generating clicks, whatever the basis for the story. For each piece that the Canary publishes, 50% of ad revenue goes to the writer, 10% to the article editor, and 20% to management. That incentivizes bullshit, because after that, you can't unclick something. Once you've clicked on it, they've lured you in, and they've got the little revenue you can get from it. Squawk Box, for example, ran a long piece supportive of the entirely invented notion there was a D notice in place to prevent the number of fatalities in Grenfell Tower being known. They knew that wasn't true. They knew it can't be true. The D notice system has no power in law. It cannot prevent the number of fatalities being known. But they put it out there. It was shared by people who were suspicious of the authorities, and it went on its way. The Canary ran a piece about the Sun ignoring the Manchester terrorist attack of 2017 on its front page, despite knowing that the front page appeared before the attack had taken place. Both outlets have been featured on the BBC. Both are now accepted into our journalistic culture. The Canaries, even regulated by the government-recognised pseudo-regulator Impress. Both are avowedly political, committed to the service of Corbynism and attacking the establishment. But the point is, I'm not trying to say that they're especially bad within our media. The old media are guilty of exactly the same approach to news. Partisanship driven to excess. Clicks at all costs. This online ecosystem of crapness, which is pretty much what modern journalism has become. And we're now collectively forced to conclude that the business model for online journalism, as every other part of journalism, is shattered unequivocally and beyond reasonable repair. When newspapers made serious money 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was no pressure on them to be well managed. So they weren't. When their industry was disrupted, there weren't enough talented people in positions of authority to respond with speed and intelligence. In 2005, the revenue of British newspapers in print and online was £4.9 billion. In 2016, it was £2.2 billion. So that's halved in that period. And of course, its cost base has gone up in that time. Newspapers have two means of obtaining income, advertising and cover price for subscription. And advertising is disappearing with no chance of recovery. Each month, more is taken by Facebook and Google, which will always have access to far more of an audience than any given journalistic outlet we have. Mail Online, 15 million users a day. It's the biggest newspaper probably in the world. Facebook has 1.2 billion users a day. Its figure over the course of a month is 2 billion, which means that 66% of people are using it every day. The New York Times in 2014 calculated that people were spending collectively 40,000 hours on the site every day. That's a lot of wasted time. And at the same time, Facebook, to all of us, is harnessing information about everyone to ensure that directly targeted advertising is most effective. The company, did you know this, has patented the technology to analyze the dust on your phone camera to identify where you've been. It says it doesn't use it, but a patent is registered in America to analyze the dust on your phone. It's worth more than $500 billion. It's more powerful than many nation states. And here's the thing about Facebook. It gets its content, the thing that powers its growth, for free. Stories from newspapers, videos from broadcasters, your pictures, your comments. The people who wish actually to make mass market online content are now locked into the same overhead problem as old-fashioned print publishers. A website like a printing press remains a tangible, unshiftable burden on resources. A room full of journalists churning out articles in their fevered flurry is still too expensive an investment, given the dwindling economic returns. Facebook, under its charming indie kid, multi-billionaire, crypto-presidential candidate Mark Zuckerberg, simply waits for everybody else to spend money producing the content, then nicks it and takes the revenue attendant upon it. Adrian LaFrance, a journalist at The Atlantic, made this inarguable point. Zuckerberg doesn't want Facebook to kill journalism as we know it. He really doesn't. But that doesn't mean that he won't. And media companies' relationship with Facebook is best summarized by that metaphor we used on Friday of narcotics. They're steadily being destroyed by their own addiction. Facebook can make or break the economy of the sites on which it takes its news. How easy it is for a story to be discovered and shared is entirely in the hands of the Facebook algorithm, what type of stories its technology has decided to promote. In 2018, Facebook announced it would deprioritize news items in favor of personal posts from friends. And that's destroyed the business model of a lot of newspapers, for example. And Facebook does it because it wants to duck responsibility for stories that are racist or fake or representative of the wincing toxicity of political debate. Facebook wants to emphasize that it's not a publisher. It doesn't want to be regulated like a publisher. It doesn't want to be treated like one. It wants to be considered to be a platform. And it's also showing that the business it's killing, journalism, isn't actually important to it at all. And this is the critical point when we think about modern journalism. Rupert Murdoch, who owns the company where I work, has suggested that Facebook should pay a carriage fee for content it's hosting, essentially channeling some money back into the hands of the media companies providing the material. It seems like a sensible argument, but Facebook's behaviour is diametrically facing the opposite direction. News is too much trouble for it. It wants to downgrade news, keep it on its life support system. And not only is journalism as we know it therefore dying, because all the money that exists goes to Facebook and Facebook can take or leave it, the corpse of journalism in this country is starting to reek a little. When publications fold, which they will do in their next 10 years, their recent online history won't be proud, authority-defying scopes in the manner of Jonathan Wilkes, who we met on Friday. It'll be from hunger click fodder scraped out of the bottom of the internet. Our collective thirst for information is now disconnected to any quality supply of it. I mentioned these on Friday, but they are striking. We always have information now. In 1720, the Gloucester News apologised for the present scarcity of news, so it simply ran fewer stories. On the 18th of April 1930, the BBC's news announcer had a script for the 8:45 news bulletin, and it said this: there is no news. So they played piano music instead. But we don't live in that world anymore. Andrew Marr, the BBC journalist, said back in 2004, the solution to the problems in journalism is in the brains and the hands and the soul of the British journalist. Said that back in 2004. And he was being charming, but he was entirely wrong. Some newspaper journalists, especially in tabloids, especially online, have hastened the decline of the industry, of course. Those who've experienced the sometimes shoddy coverage of their own lives, by newspapers particularly, will not mourn its passing at all. But print newspapers are now locked into a cycle of decline. If advertising has gone, they must increase the cover price while still cutting costs. So newspapers lose pages, writers, sub-editors, picture editors, foreign coverage and so on, but become more expensive at the same time. And this puts them, which they are all now in, an unrecoverable spin, as readers slowly realise that not only are they getting less for more money, but they get most of it for free on Facebook anyway. Meanwhile, online versions are subject to rising costs and shrinking returns, so mass journalism on any platform is swiftly becoming uneconomical. Now, the world of broadcasts, you might think, is in better shape. The BBC still has its guaranteed income, which, in light of what I've been talking about, should be celebrated rather than denigrated. But the BBC is losing the battle to attract young people. BBC One reaches less than 60% of those under 24, compared to more than 80% of older people. The average age of the BBC's total audience has gone up from 54 to 59 in the last few years. Sky may be now four times the size of the BBC, with revenue of £12 billion, and it may be joined to the vaster resources of Disney soon, but it faces competition from Netflix and Amazon, the latter of which certainly has the purchasing power to eclipse it. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Netflix and Amazon, as most people in this room will know, do good stuff, but it's very unclear whether such big companies will want ever to bear the expense of broadcast news at all. They can enter the market, they can dominate the market. Why would they bother with the troublesome business of telling stories from the news? YouTube, the video streaming site launched in 2005, was purchased a year later by Google for $1.65 billion. It's now watched by 80% of people between 18 and 49. More than a billion hours of video on it are viewed daily. More than 1.5 billion people come and look at it every month. The average session on YouTube is an extraordinary 40 minutes. It's now the dominant thing in terms of media consumption. My daughter's 9 and she had a birthday party recently, and I said, oh, what do you girls want to be when you're older? And I think 6 out of the 9 kids wanted to be YouTube personalities. Mm-hmm. And my daughter said, I want to be a newsreader. I thought, yes, mm-hmm. Proud. And she went, it's the best way of getting on Strictly Come Dancing. So I had a moment of pride. But YouTube as a thing, I mean, if you're even my age, you'll use YouTube, but it won't be a dominant part of your cultural life. Kids who are growing up of my daughter's age of 9 and a bit older, that's where they get everything. And again, there's some good stuff there. People can talk to one another. They can see far more stuff than they otherwise would have seen. But it's never going to give them news. It's never going to go and investigate stories. It's never going to do the boring and flashy stuff of journalism. So what will guarantee the future of journalism? Well, there's the football club model. a very rich person for either selfish or selfless reasons, and let's be honest, it won't be selfless reasons, will have to underwrite the losses of the business just for the love of it. They want to own a company that produces journalism. Or media businesses will have to diversify in order to support the dwindling returns from journalism with other income streams. So I work in the end for News Corp, a big American company. And it's not only in the newspaper business now, it's in the real estate website business, the digital video sourcing business, the radio business, the programmatic advertising business, and so on. Journalism will have to be the labour of love, a cost to be borne elsewhere, a drag on performance, a subsidised entity. And that's not an especially secure place to be. There's a small amount of hope, I'm finally getting to the hope, in some places. Perhaps amid the surrounding culture of cheapness and facility, that ecosystem of crapness I talked about, a counterculture is probably growing up for serious journalism that people are willing to pay for. Paywalls, charging subscriptions for content, do seem to work a bit. The Times is growing again. My paper, the TLS, as Robert mentioned, is up 20% year on year. Actually, it's done that for 2 years. The Spectator, Private Eye, the New Statesman, the Financial Times are in growth. New York Times, dubbed failing on a daily basis by Donald Trump on Twitter, increased its digital subscriptions since the first year of his presidency from 500,000 to 1.6 million. In the same period, its overall revenue declined by 2%. So it was getting people in very cheaply. The Guardian, by the way, is ideologically resistant to paywalls, although it probably could have profited from one 10 years ago. It's funded by begging letters on its website, and it's done quite well. 230,000 people make voluntary payments. The Guardian lost £45 million in 2016, which is something of a success in comparison to the £60 million it lost in 2015. Its aim in the next 3 years is to break even. And this is the rub, really. The business of serious journalism exists, but it's small as these things go. It's niche. The big beasts in the room are the tech companies, not the media companies. The only journalism that can pay is small scale, restricted in scope. And you might think, that's fine. It's a minor triumph of quality over crapness. But think of this at the same time. There is no feasible business model in Britain to support widespread court reporting or local council reporting. Any of the unremarkable but vital stories about daily existence, the unflashy basics of journalism. If the digital marketplace becomes the sole arbiter of story selection, then there will be fewer stories about planning permission or hospital closures and more about Kim Kardashian's knees. That's an ineluctable fact of life. Mass market journalism has always been sensationalist, as we discussed on Friday, tawdry, but it's always used its scale to tell serious or unimportant, or important but uninteresting stories too. In 2018, as its visibility, its viability diminishes, it becomes less able and inclined to do both. So we all lose from that, even if we're happy when certain newspapers go to the wall or we moan about the BBC. This is not, I realise, an optimistic note to end on. So here are three jokes from Twitter to cheer us all up. This is the funniest joke I've seen. Nothing will ever top this. Just sing that in your head. The Pink Panther. I like this one. I thought I'd have another literary one, at the very least. That's all from me. Thank you for listening.